White Rocket Entertainment.
White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 378.
It has been buried for thousands of years. A mystery. A secret. A threshold to the future.
Where'd you find this? I've never seen anything like this.
One man will break the code and open the door.
Well, this should read Stargate. That was in front of us the whole time.
The other will lead the way.
Why are you here?
I'm here in case you succeed.
Jackson's identified the seventh symbol.
Backup storage, reserve power, on.
What is that?
It's your Stargate.
We've opened a doorway to a world we know nothing about.
The beam has locked itself onto a point somewhere in the Kalium galaxy.
It's on the other side of the known universe.
Your turn now.
They prepared for danger.
Begin final evacuation.
They expected the unknown.
Stabilizing system.
Initiated commencement sequence.
But they could never have imagined this.
Shoot anything that comes down that ramp.
Your job here is to realign the Stargate. Can you do that or not?
I can't.
What the hell is going on?
My orders were simple. Track down signs of any possible danger. Well, I found some.
I can't make it work without the seventh symbol.
You got 7 minutes.
Now, the most amazing discovery of our time.
Jackson, wait for me.
Is about to become the most extraordinary adventure of all time. Kurt Russell, James Spader, Jay Davidson. Stargate. A Roland Emmerich film.
10, 9, 8, 7. Ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the areas. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello, and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment and by people like you, our great patrons at patreon.com. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and this week I'm joined by two of your and my favorite guests on this program over the last few years. You know them, you love them, you can't live without them, and I'll introduce them more specifically, but up front I'm just going to say it's our old friends Jim Yelton and Bobby Nash. Welcome aboard the show, guys.
Woohoo!
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, what he said.
Yes. You both are impresarios, entertainers, creators, writers, podcasters, all these various things, and so in that vein, you and I have, both of you and I have done a lot of podcasts over the years together. We've done projects together over the years. We've been at a lot of conventions together. Good Lord, between the three of us, we've been at a ton of conventions together over the years. And so you guys are kind of who I look to often first for things like what we're going to talk about today. I guess before we get into it, let me quickly ask you guys, what are you up to? Jim, you've been on the show probably more than anybody else, so let me start with you. What is your current what's going on currently that people will know you from and can find you from?
Mostly the fact that for the last couple of years I have been concentrating on just talking about all of the things that we love on my syndicated talk show Geek Universe. And like you said, going to conventions and doing things like our live Trivia Thunderdome show, which you have been a part of now.
It's great.
Since we're doing Celebrity Trivia Thunderdome now. That's mostly it. And for the last couple of months, I've been putting the finishing touches on our long gestating superhero series that my partner Steve Newton and I have been working on, called Extraordinary, which is actually going to be published sometime in the spring.
Excellent. Very good. Very good. Where can people find you?
The easiest way is to find the webpage for Geek Universe, which is geekuniverseshow.com, or they can find Geek Universe on Facebook. I'm a big Facebooker, so.
Okay. Excellent. Bobby, what's up with you?
Oh, writing. Lots and lots of writing. So, which is a good thing. So, you know, I'm still playing catch up from falling behind last year, but lots of deadlines. Getting ready for a lot of releases in 2019. Several things from 2018 got pushed back, plus what was originally scheduled. So this is going to be a busy, busy year.
Excellent.
Taking a page from your book, I'm ramping up my own publishing house interest this year, as opposed to doing it just every once in a while. Actually, trying to like treat it like a real business. So Ben Books should be rolling pretty good this year, hopefully.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. This is all very good news. And how people can find you?
BobbyNash.com is always a nice hub. I am also all over Facebook, Instagram, et cetera, et cetera. Ben Books does have a new website. It's Ben-Books.com. So check that out as well. And yeah. I'm all over the place.
Excellent. Very good. Well, we've got our credentials out there. As I'm sure folks tuning in know, this episode, it's the 25th anniversary this year of the original Stargate movie. That would be the Kurt Russell, James Spader version. And so I'm planning that maybe over the course of the next few months, we will talk about me and either one of you and anybody else that we can drag in might be talking about the, you know, more specific things, you know, particular series and episodes and whatever. But today I kind of want to kick off the whole Stargate anniversary by just looking at the overall franchise. We're going to start with the movie from 1994, and then we're going to talk about how that movie sort of led to an entire massive media franchise that includes three different TV series, web series, comic books, novels. I mean, it's not quite Star Trek in terms of its expanse. That's a no pun intended, but it is almost in a remarkably sort of astonishing way. Stargate is almost, it's kind of like a smaller but very large version of what Star Trek has done over the years. The only thing I think it probably lacks is a series of movies to go along with all the TV shows, the original movie, you know, the books, the comics, and everything else. So,
well, I think they were on their way there. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest thing that tripped up the Stargate franchise was MGM going bankrupt.
Yeah,
because that is when Stargate hit a wall. And they were just starting to do. Now they were doing direct to DVD movies, but they were doing movies that just kind of came to a complete and utter halt when MGM went bankrupt. So,
yeah, that can do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, think of all the problems it caused for the James Bond franchise, and that's the freaking James Bond franchise. So you can imagine that other properties, you know, suffered. That's a very good point. So, so let's start out by talking about the movie a little bit, and then we'll kind of talk about the things it spun out to. Now, I have to say up front that I got you two guys on here in particular. I wanted to get the two of you on here because, Bobby, you're a professed big fan of pretty much all of it, right? Okay. Jim is more skeptical of some of it. Is it correct?
Yeah, because my feelings about the entire franchise kind of, you know, go up and down depending on what part of the franchise we're talking about. Because I'm a huge fan of the movie. there's certain parts of SG-1 that I like and certain parts that I hate. I liked Atlantis and I loved Universe. So yeah, I'm all over the place with this.
And I'm kind of similar, although my feelings over the last year or so have changed a bit. And I want to state to the audience up front, okay, we're not here, all of us, to bash everything Stargate. Not at all. Various of us love different parts of it. So just stay tuned, because if we're saying negative things about one part, we're probably going to turn out and be saying really great things about other parts. We're just going to try to be very honest and even-handed toward the entire franchise in this sort of overview episode. I just want to make sure that if we start out saying anything that people don't like, they're like, oh, they're just there to trash it. We're not here to trash it. We're going to talk about the good and the bad, the high and the low. Cool.
And I'm glad you said that, because, you know, we in setting this up and you and I kind of going back and forth, I reminded you that you famously were in the room when I told probably 100 people that Stargate fans can suck it. So,
and I can't remember the context of that. What brought that on?
And it was actually one of the first panels that you and I had ever done together. Like, we had known each other beforehand, but I think it was one of the first times we were on a panel, and it was about competing fandoms kind of getting along with each other, and you know, Star Wars fans and Star Trek fans should just get together. And I remember at some point just having had enough of the whole kumbaya kind of vibe of the panel, and I just wanted to shake things up a little bit. And I think at some point somebody had mentioned, you know, that Doctor Who fans had kind of had the sobriquet of being the longest running science fiction fans, you know, overall. And then somebody said, what about Stargate? And I was just kind of like, Stargate fans can suck it, because yeah, they've only been around for like 8 years at that point. And I'm like, yeah, I get it. You know, Stargate had been around, you know, broadcast longer than Star Trek. But come on, dude. Like, you're not going to tell me Stargate fans are better than Star Trek fans.
Yeah, there are interesting fandom rivalries and animosities. I remember back after the Firefly run, the Browncoats went from being this really cool group to just being the most obnoxious, you know. It's like they discovered TV shows could be canceled before they were over and just became this overbearing group of people that you just couldn't stand to deal with for a while there. I love Firefly, but my gosh, those people were just losing their poop. So, well, anyway, okay, so now we have a little context on that. That helps. But my opinion on the entire franchise has gone up and down and around over the years. So I think this is going to be an interesting conversation. Let's go ahead and start out talking about the movie. Now, the movie came out in the fall of 1994, and it had, I've got to say, I saw it in the theater that in 94, and I have not watched it again until this morning. I started watching again this morning, and I was having trouble with my Apple TV, with my Plex server not wanting to. So I got behind, and I haven't finished rewatching it. It's been 25 years, all right, since I watched it. And I watched I got the first two-thirds of it in this morning, and it was reminding me why I felt the way about it that I thought I remembered. It's one of those things where it's been so long that you kind of remember that you like or don't like something, but you can't remember why, you know? And as I was watching it, I was going, oh, yeah. So let's start out talking about the movie. Let me ask you, Bobby, how long has it been since you watched the movie?
Oh, man, it's been a few years. I think I caught it on cable, just flipping channels one night and watched part of it. But I did see it in the theater. It was one of those rare movies. I actually saw it in the theater when it came out. But I enjoyed it in the movie. I remember the movie, there was very little fanfare for this movie when it came out. I remember there were not a lot of advertisements. It just kind of was there.
I agree.
Being a sci-fi nut that I am, you know, it was right in my wheelhouse. And I remember enjoying the movie. And I know there had been talks of a sequel that never materialized, but I enjoyed the movie, and I enjoyed Kurt Russell and James Spader's performances. So it was fun to watch for them.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Jim, what are your memories just in general first about the movie?
Well, like you, I saw it. In fact, I was trying to remember if I saw it opening weekend when it came out, and I'm pretty sure I did. I think I saw it either the Friday or Saturday that it opened, and I liked it a lot. And it was probably the first thing that I had seen that Dean Devlin and Roland Emmerich had done. And, you know, this was the beginning of them going on to do Independence Day and, you know, Godzilla and the Patriot with Mel Gibson. And, you know, I've always been a fan of Dean Devlin, and especially more in recent years with some of the TV shows that he's done, like Leverage and The Librarians and things like that. And I always have felt that Devlin more than Emmerich is the reason why I like Stargate, because as one of the co-writers and the producer of this, like, he's just in my wheelhouse as far as creating really quirky characters that I enjoy watching go on an adventure. You know, that's his deal. And, you know, that was the thing that drew me to Stargate the movie, was I liked these characters a lot. I mean, the setting and the story was interesting to me as a science fiction fan, but it was really the characters. And I love Spader in this movie, and, you know, Kurt Russell's great. In fact, I remember coming out of the theater that night and my roommate at the time looking at me and kind of laughing and saying, "You were totally Daniel Jackson." Like, the way that you act around people and interact with people, that's you. And I was like, I've never thought about myself in those terms, but the awkward quirkiness that he has was, I guess, me at the time. So I enjoyed it a lot, and it didn't surprise me that the guys that did that movie went on to do Independence Day, because they basically take what worked with Stargate and, you know, amp it up a thousand times greater for Independence Day.
Which seems like it didn't come out too much later than this, did it? That must have come along pretty soon.
No, it was just in a couple of years after this. Yeah,
I'd forgotten that they were responsible for that one too, and that makes a lot of sense.
I'm sure the success of Stargate probably helped.
Yeah.
Independence Day, which had a much bigger budget, had happened.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And much bigger returns too.
And that's one of the reasons why we never got the Stargate sequel, because I think every time the two of them sat down and started talking to MGM about, okay, are we going to do a sequel? How do we do a sequel? One, their price tag jumped up post Independence Day. So, you know, MGM, you know, budgetarily, a Stargate sequel was going to be way bigger than this first movie. I remember when it came out, like, in the trades, it was a big deal that they were paying Kurt Russell like $5 million to make this movie. And that he was like one of the biggest line items on the budget. And I mean, when you look at it, it's a beautiful movie.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, visually it's great looking. And, you know, when you consider that it's a relatively low budget movie, they've really put all of the money on the screen, including the $5 million they spent for Kurt Russell.
he's $5 million on the screen.
Yeah. Kurt Russell, who has famously said, "I did it for the money."
Yeah, well, and
he has said that, he, like, when he read the script, he said, "It'll be fun, but this movie will never do anything."
Yeah, well, you know, and I was going to say, because I look at this movie and I'd forgotten about the connection to Independence Day, and I can totally see that now, because both of them look really great, they're fun, and yet they're both a little brain dead in certain ways, and that make me just grit my teeth and bang my head on the wall. And so,
oh yeah,
I
the plot is pretty simple.
Yeah, So I go back and I'm rewatching it, and here's what I would say, Jim, what you were just saying about making a sequel. I think they made the right decision for whatever, whether it was motivated by money or whatever. I think they made the right decision to turn it into a TV series and a number of TV series, because at its heart, okay, at its heart, what this whole concept is people exploring alien worlds by walking. And that,
right.
if there's ever been a premise for a TV show, there's Star Trek, which is people exploring alien worlds by flying, and there's Stargate, which is exploring alien worlds by walking. So what it enables, I had a friend, you know, years ago that was watching it when I wasn't, that said, no, you got to watch it. It's the perfect concept for a sci-fi TV show. I'm like, what do you mean? They're like, it's the perfect concept because you've got modern technology. I know over the course of the various TV shows, the humans either develop or acquire really good technology. I mean, they end up being basically Star Trek. But at the beginning, they're basically Air Force personnel with machine guns going and visiting alien planets. And that's pretty much how it is through most of the shows. And well, that really works.
I like the fact, too, that when we get to the TV series, that actually ends up working in their favor.
Uh-huh.
That we are not as advanced as the people we're going up against, because they don't quite have they're not used to our level of technology. So firing bullets kind of throws them.
Yeah. Yeah,
but that is really a good defense for that, because they're used to laser weapons or what. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things as we go along. I'll say that the TV shows, and particularly the first one, SG-1, I think what they did really well, they took the concepts that worked from the movie. They took the broad general concepts and some of the specific concepts from the movie, and some of the very specific characters that worked from the movie, and tweaked them just a little bit and built off of that. You know, in other words, some of the stuff in the movie that there's not a lot that they didn't use from the movie, but they were really able, I think, to be very effective and very selective in how they constructed the TV universe based on this. So here's a couple of things I noticed from watching the movie, and I'll get any feedback from you guys that you want to. First, they just to run through this real quickly, when they discover the Stargate at the beginning of 1928, they immediately use ropes to turn it upright. And I'm thinking, why did they know to do that? Why would they not think it was just a circle sitting on the ground? I don't know, but they set it up. Okay. And then when they go and get Daniel Jackson in present day, which is, I guess, 94, they have it in the Colorado mountain base already with all the computer stuff, the dialing their home, you know. Basically, they found a Stargate that didn't have a dialing system. They had to build their own. And I'm just, if they needed Daniel Jackson to figure out what it did, how did they know to build the dialing system before he got there? I've never understood.
I've always wondered that. It always seemed like they never explained exactly what they were stuck on early on. You know, they just kind of throw this idea out like, hey, we've got this thing. We don't know what it does. Mm-hmm. And yet we've created all this technology to make it work.
Yeah. And they even say we've gotten 6 of the digits dialed. We just don't know what the 7th digit is. Couldn't they have just dialed every other digit once to see what happens?
Right.
But then instead they brought him in to translate, to figure out that the little upside down pyramid, the little pyramid thing, the little triangle is the point of origin, Earth. So anyway, and then here's the other thing. So they go through to the other Egyptian planet, right? The first planet they visit, and they take Daniel Jackson along because he promises he can get them back. And then when they get there, there's no DHD, the dial home device. There's no dialing thing there either, at least that they know how to work.
And so, no writing.
Yeah, and so they're like, well, we're trapped. Oh, my gosh, we're trapped. And they're mad at him. And I'm thinking, why not just have Stargate Command dial back in an hour?
Right, because the show, the movie does not explain that as well as the show does, that if you don't, you can't walk through it unless you dial it out. You know, so if they dial in from Earth, they couldn't walk back through it from the other planet. It only goes one way at a time.
All right, Bobby, I've watched every episode now once or twice or three times, and I didn't get that.
Yes, it's mentioned in there that the wormhole only goes one way at a time. There's another one where they're trapped and they're like, you know, like it's mentioned that we can't, you know, well, what if they just dial in and we can't go out that way? Huh. That you can only. Now, in the pilot, they do it that way and they realize they made an error and they never mentioned that again.
Oh, okay.
But yes, it's mentioned in the show that you cannot, it only goes one way at a time.
Okay. Well, you can.
It's not like an open tunnel.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, they.
Well, and you point out like the biggest problem that I have with the movie, and that's that both Stargates, both the one that's on Earth, and then the one that they end up coming through.
Yeah.
On the alien planet, neither one of them has a dialing device.
Right.
And. It makes no sense to me that you've got this alien civilization that creates these Stargates and just leaves them with no way to dial them.
Well, they weren't the ones that created it, though. The ancients that created them. Well, that may be TV lore as opposed to movie lore.
Yes, TV lore.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. Like, whoever created the Stargates left them there.
But then again, in the movie, the aliens, you know, they don't actually call them ghouls and all that, but the aliens, mm-hmm. Ra, mm-hmm. they don't want the people to be able to use it. So
yeah,
my guess is it's in his ship.
Okay.
That's my guess. They don't say that.
Well, and on Earth, they had buried it and covered it up. So they wouldn't have had they'd have probably destroyed the dialing device and covered up the Stargate so it couldn't be opened remotely. That does make sense, I guess. Yeah. But
because in the movie, there is a ship over Earth in the past when they revolt because they leave by ship.
Yeah.
Right.
And on the other planet, they're there by ship. So, since they got the ships, why they have Stargates too, I didn't, you know.
Well, it's just easier.
Yeah, but
they can do radio.
I always assume that the dialing device was in the ship in the movie.
It makes sense. Well, they
but they don't expressly say that.
They do radio communications back and forth though through it, which is kind of weird. But okay. Let me see. Oh yeah, the other thing, and this was something that I've always sort of laughed about with a TV show is that everybody speaks perfect American or Canadian English. And the problem is, I've always thought, well, that's kind of silly. But then in the movie, nobody speaks English, and it's annoying the crap out of me. And I'm like, you know what? I'm glad. I see the value now. I see the value on the TV show in just automatically having everybody speak English because, man, it's annoying. There's this long middle section of the movie where the Air Force guys and Daniel are with the Egyptian people on the planet. And they can't communicate with each other, and it's just frustrating as crap trying to, you know. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, you know, I'm glad that they did figure out I guess it's kind of the Farscape solution where you go through the Stargate and magically it makes you be able to understand each other. I don't know.
Yeah. I also think, too, I mean, one of the things it's a conceit of the show that I think helped that helped the TV series save money is that there were humans on every planet because – mm-hmm. All of those planets were populated by people stolen from Earth.
Yeah, the Tari. Yeah,
so
that's right.
Which was great because now we don't have to come up with alien makeup for every planet we visit.
Now they did some. You're right. They did some, but not.
Right, but it was not. It was not as big an issue. It's
And Bobby, we'll get to this in a minute, and Jim, you probably missed it too. But the solution they came up with that on Stargate Universe is like insanely. Brilliant. We'll get to that in just a minute, right? They're on the other side of the freaking universe in Stargate Universe, and they find human civilizations. And the reason why is one of those things you're just like, okay. But one more thing about the movie up front, and that is, if you hear my crackling, I have a Fifth Avenue bar here. There is a scene in the movie where Daniel Jackson gives the Egyptian guy a Fifth Avenue, and since I happen to have one here, nice, okay.
Now you gotta say that, Bonnie Way. I remember that. I don't know why I remember that line from the movie. So product placement works, people.
There you go. All right. So I thought it'd be fun to enjoy a Fifth Avenue while we do this. Yep. All right.
Now, I will say, too, that that does make me say, you know, we were talking about, you know, Kurt Russell and James Spader and all. I do love Eric Avari in the role of, well, we from the TV show, we know his name is Kasuf, but as the leader of the Egyptian people. Yeah. Eric Avari, who is a big character actor.
They brought him back.
He does reprise the role on the TV show, as does
the kid.
The kid who plays Skara, Alexis Cruz, who played Skara.
Mm-hmm.
He does reprise his role in the show as well.
Yeah, I did. I was fascinated to see, because like I said, it had been so long. I was amazed to see how many people they were able to bring back. I don't know if the woman is the same.
And no, it's a different woman. It's a different woman. And it's because those two that reprise their role keep coming back. I mean, because the last season before the new cast comes on, they're in that near there too. So, I mean, they're in it for a while, off and on.
Let me ask you this, you guys. We do not have a Major Carter, Samantha Carter, or a Teal'c in the movie, do we?
No.
No.
They're entirely from the TV show.
Right.
And that's interesting. I mean, the Teal'c type character, obviously the idea of the Jaffa and one of them switching over, that makes perfect sense. And you see that type of character in the movie, and they just kind of had one switch over sides, which makes sense. But I'm surprised that there was no Major Carter type character. I mean, did they just decide they needed a female character and decide
that
to
would
make,
be my guess, yeah.
Decide well, to make yeah. her the technical person?
You are about to embark on a top-secret military mission through a doorway of adventure, over the threshold of time, to the point of no return. Richard Dean Anderson takes adventure to a whole new dimension. You just never know what will be on the other side. Until you get there. Stargate SG-1, the gateway to the edge of the universe.
And I think if we're kind of wrapping up the movie and kind of segueing into when SG-1 started, I mean, Carter's a good segue, because I've always felt, and it was obvious seeing the stories that were coming out during, you know, the pre-production phase of the show, that, you know, MGM had a big hit with The Outer Limits on Showtime. Mm-hmm. And they were starting to mine their back catalog for things. And they basically just put out a memo to all of the creative talent that was working with them on various shows and said, pitch us ideas based on things that we own the rights to.
Mm.
And, you know, that's how these guys got together. And they actually both separately pitched Stargate to MGM as separate projects, and then MGM was like, well, you guys are both working on the same idea, start working together and come up with something. And it always seems to me like what they did was they sat down and almost came up with like a checklist that they used to kind of build the series Bible for SG-1. And it was like, you know, we want it to be Star Trek. So they're going to go to a different planet every week.
Yep.
They're going to have, you know, a different adventure of the week.
Yep.
We want it to be a team. We want it to be four people. We have to have an alien. What was different? What can we do different from the movie? We have to have a female character, because nobody wants to watch four guys every week. Yeah. You know, we have to bring in a female audience. So we need to have Carter. We need to have this. We need to have that. And, you know, it seemed to me early on that it was very much a paint by numbers sort of show.
Right. Well, I mean, with Carter and Teal'c in the show, they also serve an additional purpose that shorthands things. Mm-hmm. Teal'c, being the alien with who is familiar with everything out there, when you go to planets, he can just drop information that mm-hmm. we don't have to go find.
Right.
And Carter can drop the technobabble that would seem out of place if O'Neill or Jackson did it.
How funny is it that she's basically the MacGyver on a show that has MacGyver already on it?
Exactly. Yes.
So, yeah. I like that. Right. So let's do talk about the SG-1 a little bit, and I'm going to break it down into two segments. All right. I want to talk because it's almost two separate shows. In fact, there's some talk of that they were going to change the name of the show going into season 9. I'm going to back up a little bit.
It was going to be changed to Stargate Command.
Mm-hmm.
And they, for whatever and reason, it was a last minute decision to leave it as SG-1 mm-hmm. for things like running it in syndication and
yeah,
it was simpler. It made more sense.
It does. It makes sense. But it did change pretty drastically, including the cast.
Your main star changed.
Well, the general changed. The main star changed. The only people that were consistent were the three besides Richard Dean mm-hmm. Anderson. And even then, Major Carter or Colonel Carter at that point, she wasn't on there for a while anyway. But anyway, let's back up. All right. So I want to look at the first seven just seasons kind of in a box really quickly, okay? Because the first seven seasons are pretty much all the same. I would argue the only thing different in the entire first seven seasons is that one season you have a different guy, a guy replacing Daniel Jackson for 1 year.
Daniel Jackson 2 comes in.
Yeah. And then turns around and leaves after a year. Yeah.
Yeah. And I will also say, too, there is just a slight tonal difference. It's very minor. But remember, the first five seasons took place on Showtime.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a little more adult things, especially in the early season.
That's true.
Like, there's full-blown nudity in the first one.
Yeah.
And there's some language that couldn't be used on Sci-Fi. But I think they started toning that down. So by the time it moved to Sci-Fi, it wasn't a huge change.
Yeah, I would agree.
But the episodes did get shorter because when they were on Showtime, they were an hour.
Oh, yeah.
When they went to Sci-Fi, they were 45 minutes.
And also, they do fewer episodes in a season. They're down to 20 by the end. They're over 20 at the beginning, but they're down to just 20 per. That's why the 200th episode is not like the first. It's not. You would think the 200th episode would be the last episode if there were 10 seasons of 20, but the 200th episode actually comes about 8 into the last season,
mm-hmm.
which we'll talk about in a minute. So, okay, so the first the reason I say the first seven is because they were very, very similar, except for Corin Nemec coming in for a year. But other than that, they're pretty similar. So let's talk about those. These are the seven seasons I don't really like. It was a slog.
There's nothing in those seven seasons
No. These are the seven that it took me like 3 years to get through watching on Hulu. Okay. I just had to slog through them a few at a time and I would get bored and go watch something else. Because there are a handful of episodes all across those seven seasons that I really like where they do something unique and special. Like, for example, the 2010 the episode that was called 2010,
mm-hmm.
that one I thought was brilliant. There were several others that were brilliant, but the problem I have with the first seven seasons is it's the same thing almost every episode. It's always the same villains, pretty much. It's always the same situation. It's the same, almost the same cast. What I wish. Okay, and then I want to get your guys' impression of the first seven, but let me get my point. What I wish is that they had done what they did in the first seven seasons in like four seasons and then changed to what they did in season 8 and 9 in like season 5. I just felt like they dragged the same thing out way too long. Now, Bobby, how do you respond to that? First seven seasons.
I agree. They had a formula. They knew what worked for them. They did recur villains. Yes, even I groaned every time the replicators came back after being destroyed. But then again, you know what? That's not a thing indicative to Stargate. How many times do the Daleks come back to face Doctor Who after being ultimately destroyed for the final time?
And they're not called the replicators for nothing, you know?
Right. So, and then they become human replicators, and then they become, you know, so yes, they knew they had tropes and they did them. Now there are some things with, as the show started going on, one of the things you start to notice around season 5 and 6 and 7 especially, Richard Dean Anderson's role gets smaller.
Yeah.
Because he started taking more time off. Mm-hmm. He would miss episodes, or he would only be in it at the beginning of the episode and at the end of the episode, but not in the middle. Or so they did start doing this thing where characters would split up, where it wasn't, you know, two people are over here doing something and they're over here doing, you know, which kind of carries on through the end. They do that a lot through the Ben Browder years as well, where the characters are off in different places. It becomes more of a, it becomes less the Planet of the Week show at that point. So I agree. There are some episodes that are just episodes. I still enjoy those first 7 seasons, primarily for the characters. The characters were so much fun that even when the plots were lacking, the characters made it worth watching.
I would agree with that to a certain extent. Again, just little long, but yes, I agree. Now, Jim, before I get your take, because I'm thinking this is the part you probably like the least of all of it. This is my theory, and it's the part that I like the least of all of it, so I totally would understand if that's your view, but I just want to say one more thing to what Bobby said, which is, I think in the first 7 seasons, when they would do like a time travel episode, an alternate universe episode, or an outer space episode, like outer space, those I really enjoyed. It's just that there was like one of those for about every 10 where they go to some medieval planet and like the Puritan people want to lock them in a jail and torture them or something. And I had enough of that.
There are some, like you mentioned 2010, that's a fantastic episode. Yes. There's a great episode. I don't know episode titles off the top of my head, so please forgive me.
That one just stuck with me.
There's a really good, I am not a big fan of the season 6 where I work Corn. I did not care for the Jonas season much.
I like Jonas
that
a lot.
That said, two of my favorite episodes happen in that season.
Ah, there you go.
So, there's one where Teal'c dreams that he's a human firefighter.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
And Daniel Jackson is there helping him through this, and it's all a fever dream because him and Braytac are near death on a planet, and they're passing their symbiote back and forth. Yeah. I think that is an absolutely fantastic episode.
It really is good, yeah.
And then there's another one in that season where Jonas isn't there, but they're at the Alpha site, and there's an invisible killer picking off the various people.
Yeah.
And I just there's just so much good character bits in that, and that just I love that one. That one's one of my favorites.
I gotta say the Jaffa. As much as I like Teal'c and Braytac, the Jaffa to me are the when an episode is all about them, I just start to go to sleep. Yeah. There's a lot of that I love. They're the least part.
Yeah, because to me, and you're right. When you guess that the first 7 seasons were probably what I disliked the most out of the run, but actually the first 2 seasons I really enjoyed. Okay. It was just like Bobby pointed out, you know, if Doctor Who was every episode was the Daleks and the Cybermen, you'd get tired of that.
Mm-hmm.
And the mythology of Stargate is so closely tied to the Goa'uld and the Ancients and these Stargates that it's tough for you to do an episode that deviates from that lane. Mm-hmm. Because if you do, then it's not Stargate anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of backed themselves into a corner by tying the mythology of the Stargate so closely to one race of aliens. And so, you know, you do get this show that is basically them fighting the same villains every week. And it, as opposed to, you know, Star Trek, where you'd get the Klingons every once in a while, but then they'd have all of these other adventures. You know, with Stargate, it's the Goa'uld for huge chunks of the first handful of seasons, and the Ancients, and and you're fighting the same villain, so that when you do deviate, those are the special episodes. Yeah. Where it's like, oh, they're not fighting the same people this week. Well, this is cool. I like this episode. Or this doesn't have anything to do with the overall story arc, and I like it. Those were few and far between early on, though. And it wasn't until, you know, later on in the show's run when they started to open up the universe a little bit more. And they had pretty much exhausted everything that they could do with the couple of alien races that they had been working with early on. And, you know, like you guys, I mean, it's funny because when you look at Stargate, when you look at the production, when you look at behind the scenes things and how storytelling is affected by production issues, you know, when you have the star of your show come to you and say, hey guys, I'm not going to make 20 episodes this year. I only want to do 15. Well, that means you have to figure out a way for O'Neill to not be in every episode of the show. When Amanda Tapping comes to you and says, hey guys, I'm going to have a baby. You have to figure out a way that she's not going to be running and jumping and shooting for huge stretches of a season because she's going to go have a baby. And the Daniel Jackson thing's like the big one for me because, you know, Michael Shanks went to them and said, I'm not happy with what you have me doing. Daniel Jackson, I think especially like in season 3 and 4, I always referred to him as just generic science guy. Mm-hmm. Because in the movie, he's very specifically, you know, an archaeologist.
Right.
And he's a specialist in Egyptology and the sort of thing that they need him to do. In the TV show, he knows everything about every science there is. Yeah. And what he doesn't know, Carter kind of fills in.
Yeah.
So I just think Michael Shanks became very frustrated that he had become generic science guy. And when he comes to you and says, hey, I don't think I'm going to come back for the next season because you're not writing my character the way that I feel he should be written, that kind of puts you behind the eight ball as creators.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you only have two choices. And I think when they moved to sci-fi, they had to deal with reduced budgets. They had to deal with Michael Shanks not being happy. And it was just easier for them to say, okay, well, we'll pay somebody else less money to come in and fill that role on the show. And it really backfired for them because everybody missed Daniel and wanted Michael Shanks back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but he's really also good. Allowed them to explore other corners of the Stargate universe and do some things that they may not have done creatively otherwise.
Well, and I think, too, with Daniel Jackson, I mean, his story does kind of come to a, or his main focus comes to a halt because they do take care of the, you know, the whole thing of him trying to find his wife who had been taken.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it like season 3 when that's taken care of?
It's very early, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And at that point, his reason for being there is just because he's in the main credits of the show.
Mm-hmm. He's just part of, well, he's part of SG-1, but you don't really know why really anymore, unless, like Jim said, you kind of give him other things he's suddenly good at that he wasn't before.
Well, they tried that thing, a whole thing about finding the kid, and then they wrapped that up, and then it's just, he's just there. Yeah. You're right, yeah. And I think when they brought him back, they gave him a little more to do.
Well, but they do the whole thing where he ascends, you know, and that becomes important then because he's had connections with the Ancients in the last few seasons.
Right.
Which is a whole new thing, really. Especially
when that also, when they brought him back to that, that also gave him a purpose. It gave the character a purpose. It's been, at least for that first season.
Well, and
when, trying to recall what had happened, et cetera, et cetera.
I think when they're fighting Anubis, right, who's like a half-ascended Gua'ul, half
kind of stuck whatever. In the middle.
Yeah. He's basically Lucifer, sort of. And so you need somebody with magical powers to be able to go up against him. And there's a couple of really good scenes where, like magical Daniel fights magical Anubis. And that's pretty cool because we hadn't seen that before. So I give him credit for that. All right, well, let's look at at seasons 8, 9, and 10. The reason I lumped them together, I know you'd think 9 and 10 are basically one big season. They're different, but I'm including 8 because 8 is the season where you lose Jack pretty much. He's not there nearly as much, like you were saying, Bobby, in season 8.
That's the year he becomes the general.
Yeah, so he's barely on the show. Yeah, he replaces General Hammond and is barely... that's true. He's in Stargate Command a lot, but he doesn't go out on the actual missions. He just basically sits around his office complaining about the chair and stuff like that. And then, which means he still gets to be funny, but it's not really like him out in a combat suit with a machine gun patrolling streets and looking for aliens and stuff. But then also this is the season where they pretty much wrap up the Gua'ul arc for good.
Yeah.
With the exception, I got to say, of our old buddy Ball, and I have to say that because Ball.
There are still Gould running around.
There are, yeah, but I mean,
their power base is pretty much gone.
But Ball becomes the main Gould presence for the entire rest of the show and into the movies. I mean, it's just him, and he's awesome. I love that actor, and I think he does such a great job. In fact, there's even an episode in season 9 or season 10 where Ball teams up with SG-1 because they're working together and they're kind of trapped and stuff, and I love that. I just love the idea. It reminds me of like Avengers Forever when Kang is helping the Avengers, you know? It's like their worst enemy is there with them, and they're trading those little snarky comments and everything, and I just love that. I thought that was one of the high points of the entire series, is where they have Ball teamed up with them. I just think that's awesome. So,
there's a great line from that same season 9, where when they find out that like there's clones of Ball and Ball's hiding on Earth, you know, and there is a funny line where they're like, it's like, well, he's on Earth, we'll find him. And Carter goes like, who would have thought a few years ago a Gua'ul on Earth would have been like at DEFCON 1.
Yeah, that's right.
Now it's effed. We don't care.
And he starts wearing business suits too. I love that Ball basically becomes like a Marvel villain or like the Kingpin or something in the last couple of seasons. Instead of he abandons the whole Egypt shtick of I am Ball, you'll worship me. And he's more like a business tycoon working, you know, behind the scenes deals. It's hilarious. But anyway, all right. So Jim, let me hear from you about 8, 9, and 10. And particularly, guys, I want to talk about the introduction of Vala Maldoran and Cam Mitchell. In other words, the Farscape invasion, right?
Well, I was going to say, because I was a super huge fan of Farscape.
Yes.
And was depressed beyond depressed when it was canceled. Mm-hmm. And it was funny because when I heard that they were going to take, you know, the two leads from Farscape and put them on Stargate, I was like, there's no way I'm going to be happy with this. And yet I was very happy with it because they didn't do what I thought they were going to do, which is basically have them play the same characters from Farscape.
Yes.
And just redress them and rename them. I mean, they actually gave both of them as actors almost completely different characters.
Basically opposite, Jim. They basically swapped them opposite.
And I loved that.
Yes.
And I thought it was a brilliant idea from the producers. And I'm sure, it worked for the cast. And I loved that they had Vala and Daniel Jackson.
Yes.
In, you know, this... They were the ones that were having the romantic, you know, will there or won't they, or, you know, sort of thing. And I loved everything because I felt like it was a great way to hit the reset button on the show. And I almost wish they had done it a year or two earlier.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
But they couldn't have done that because Farscape was still on, and you know, Claudia Black and Ben Browder were working. So,
yeah.
But it was. I mean, and it opened the door for them to do some things that they hadn't done in a while with the show, and I really felt like it was a much fresher take on Stargate once season 8 and particularly in season 9. It really felt like, okay, this is the Stargate show that I wanted all along.
I don't think it did Ben Browder any favors. I like Cam Mitchell. I like him for what he is, but it was a combination of him having to play him straight up, just serious and grim almost, and the fact that there's only a handful of episodes in seasons 9 and 10 where he gets the chance to really do a lot with his own character beyond just be like the officer there to kind of take over and I'm in charge. And so, but on the other hand, my gosh, Claudia Black was a revelation in this. In Farscape, she just stomps around being mean all the time. But in this, she is hilarious. She's amazing in this.
And this is one of those things, too, where you really have to thank Amanda Tapping for this, because Claudia Black is there because Amanda Tapping got pregnant.
Mm-hmm. She did one episode.
They needed someone to round out. And because Claudia Black had appeared in an episode in season 8.
Right. That's what I was getting at.
Where she steals the Prometheus, and that's where she and Daniel meet. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, bringing her in was just... And obviously, we as fans fell in love, and then they brought her back. But I thought the way they brought her back was smart. It tied her to the plot. Mm-hmm. She fit really well with everybody. Who knew she could be that funny? She's absolutely adorable. You go from one of those times where you can, you know, she's not like a goody-goody character, mm-mm, but she can go, so she can play mischievous and kind of almost evil at times to really lovable. And you're right, Ben Browder's kind of a one note, just he's the military guy.
Vala has a fascinating character arc too. I mean, she actually gets a chance to play quite a range, because like you say, when we first see her in season 8 in that one episode, she's a villain. She's absolutely... Yeah, she's like a more serious Harry Mudd kind of villain, you know.
And she is out. She is looking out for Vala.
Yeah, and by the by halfway through season, I guess 9 or 10.
Yeah,
she's part of the team, and they trust her.
She when she leaves the show in season 9, because you know she's gone for part of almost half a season.
Yeah.
When she leaves, we think she dies being selfless, trying to save everyone.
That's right.
I mean. That's not something the Vala of season 8 would have done.
No.
And so, yes, she grows a lot. And then especially in season 9, when we find out that, you know, the Ori basically, raped her and forced her to have a child.
Yeah. We're about to get into the Ori, and I want to talk about them for sure, because we talked about the Goa'uld. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I definitely want to talk about the Ori, I have to mention before we move on, though, the one thing about Vala that I really just love, and I like flipped out when I first saw this, was that for the first half of season 9, I guess it is, she's not part of the team. And so the opening credits, you know what I'm getting at, right? The opening credits is the four regular characters, Ben Browder and the three others, walking up the ramp and going through the wormhole in the classic, you know, right stuff kind of pose, you know. Halfway through, when she comes on and there's an episode where she gets her patches, you know, she gets to be part of the team. She gets her uniform and she's like sworn in as part of it as the fifth member of SG-1. And then at the very beginning of the next episode, when they're walking up the little ramp to doing their little hero strut, the door opens behind them and Vala comes running out. Mm-hmm. And she joins them and walks up the ramp with them. And I was like, oh, yeah. Because that's the kind of thing that, like, Babylon 5 was always good at, right? Of changing the credits and changing things to reflect how the show has changed. But shows that are more episodic often don't get that right. They kind of stick with their same thing. I give them enormous credit for changing the opening credits halfway through the season to reflect that Vala and capturing her personality, right? She's late. Mm-hmm. She's just joining them. She comes running up behind them with her little pigtails and everything. I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah.
And I've always wanted to ask if somebody who would know, because I'm sure that they made the decision to recut the opening credits to include that new shot. But I've always wondered if that was something that was planned,
yeah,
or if they got to the set to shoot them walking up the ramp as a team, you know, all five of them, and somebody on the day said, "Hey, you know what? Maybe we should have her run in late," and you know, or if that was like, you know, an extra take that they did, just to kind of have fun with it and see how it worked. I would like to know that.
Yeah.
Well, also going up when they go up the ramp, because all five of them can't walk through the gate side by side. It's not wide enough.
Yeah.
The first three go through, and it is her and Daniel walking through behind them side by side too.
Oh, that's sweet.
And that's you really know, true. And while we're talking about the new additions. I don't want to gloss over the addition of Beau Bridges.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
As General Landry, you know, Beau Bridges is kind of a pretty good get for a sci-fi channel show.
Absolutely.
I
was like, are you kidding?
He's certainly a hot part of Hollywood royalty, and I think he plays the character really well.
He does a great
and does not carbon copy anything either Richard Dean Anderson or Don Davis did before.
In fact, I got to say, as much as we all love Don Davis and he was so good as Hammond, I think that Beau Bridges, they ask him to do a lot more stuff than they ever asked Don Davis to do. And I think that I'm not sure, again, for all that Don Davis was wonderful and we love him, right? For all that he was so good at, I'm not sure he was kind of a one-note guy. Right. And when he did that one note, he was great at it. But Beau Bridges is asked to be much more nuanced in his performances in seasons 9 and 10 in the movies. So any thoughts on that before we go on to the movies?
I think you're right. But, you know, it's and you know, when you bring something like that up, like you said, you don't want to slight what Don Davis did and what he brought to the table. But there is a difference when you're writing for Don Davis versus when you know that you're going to be writing for Beau Bridges, you know, and just the stature of the actor kind of causes you as a producer and a writer to say, okay, well, we have to feature this guy a little bit more than we would have Hammond. Like, you know, Landry has to be in, we have to give him more juicy stuff to do, or else we're wasting having Beau Bridges on our show.
That's fair. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And there was some great stuff with him. I mean, I know they gave him the stuff with he had his daughter, but I did love some of the stuff with, I don't remember the character's name, but the one Gould that comes in to help them and turns out
Like the Roman emperor guy. The glutton guy.
He's always eating.
Yes, yes, yes.
I can't remember his name either.
But
I thought the stuff they did there was brilliant with his interrogating him and, you know, first trying to appease him and be a delegate and seeing that moment where Landry goes from being a diplomat to a soldier. He kind of turns on the guy when he realizes he's screwing with us.
That's right. Yeah.
And again, there's just a lot of good stuff there.
That stuff I'm not sure Don Davis would have done the same way as well. You know what I mean? Just a different. But all right, that's going to carry us to the first of the movies real quick, and that means we got to talk about the Ori. And I thought the Ori were great. I thought that they should have had 5 seasons instead of 2. I thought that they were a very welcome breath of fresh air, being a completely – I started to say they're a completely different type of villain, but they're not. Here's the thing about the Ori. In a lot of ways, they're different. In a lot of ways, they still fit within the overall SG-1 mythology, which is people pretending to be gods and controlling their their servants. In this case, though, it even better fits in with the SG-1 franchise version because they're tied into the ancients. Right. Yeah. So in other words, it's not just a race of alien worms that go in your head or whatever. They're actually part of the pre-established mythology of the show. They're just the evil versions of them. You know, they're like evil angels or something at this point. And by the way, I got to say, I love the ancients and everything about them, which is we're going to get to in just a minute with Atlantis, because Atlantis is basically the ancient show, I would argue. And Universe a little bit too. So the Ori and then carrying that over into the Ark of Truth. Your thoughts, Jim? Jim, go first. What do you think about that?
You know, it was weird because I feel like the movies were, you know, they knew that they weren't going to continue the show, that, you know, there were behind the scenes things that were causing a season 11 to not happen. And that I think when they started this arc with the Ori, that they had much more story planned than the two or three seasons that they got out of it. And I think you're right. I think it was, you know, planned as like a four or five season arc. And now they have to cram two seasons worth of story into a couple of direct to DVD movies and try and get the story out there for the fans. And I appreciate the fact that the producers went to the mat with MGM and said, you at least have to let us make these movies. Like, we have to finish the story for the fans, because not only the fans of SG-1, but Atlantis was still on, you know, we're working on another, a third series. I mean, there's a fan base that we need to service here. I felt like it was kind of rushed story-wise, though, because of that. Like, it felt like they really needed the long-form storytelling of a 20-episode TV season to really tell the story properly.
Yeah, any kind of like a two-hour thing to wrap up a storyline is always going to kind of feel that way. Bobby, what did you think about the Ori and about Ark of Truth?
I enjoyed the Ark of Truth. It was nice that they got to wrap up the story. Mm-hmm. I hate that they didn't get to, that they had to wrap it up in a separate thing, because now if you watch when I did my rewatch, even though I own the DVDs, I was watching them. They're on El-Ray shows, two episodes a day. And for a while there, I was just watching the two episodes of Stargate a day. Mm-hmm. When you get to the last episode of season 10, it does not go into the Ark of Truth next. So if you're not if you didn't go out and buy the DVD, you don't know how the story ends.
Well, it's so Hulu doesn't have it, and I'd been watching SG-1 right. on Hulu, but I found it on Amazon Prime, so that's how I was able to watch the two movies.
But because to that point, though, because I always hear that a lot, where, you know, if we jump, you know, franchises, I remember all those people that were very upset that Deep Space Nine didn't get their own movie. You should have wrapped up the Dominion War in a movie. And I'm like, no. And here's why.
Yeah.
Yep.
I of the two movies, I remember Continuum more than I do Ark of Truth. I don't exactly remember how it ends right off the top of my head at the moment. So I've probably only seen it a couple times.
I just watched it like a week ago, so for the first time as I finished the series, so it's very fresh on my mind, and I'll say a couple of things about it in a second. But go ahead and wrap up.
I really enjoyed Continuum. I don't know if we want to talk about that or not.
Yeah, I'm going to say a little bit about it real quick.
Okay, I really enjoyed Continuum as a standalone movie.
Exactly.
Now, if you know Stargate history, you know, a lot more of it makes more sense. I do understand, before MGM went bankrupt, that the movies were part of the Stargate plan. That because that was why Atlantis ended after 5. They were going into movies as well, which obviously didn't happen. And there was a third SG-1 movie that was in production. It was written, and they had started putting stuff together for it that was going to be a Jack O'Neill-centric movie.
Yeah, I bet it was.
Yeah. That Richard Dean Anderson was on board. He was going to come in. It was going to feature him heavily. And then MGM went, oh, we're out of money. Yeah. And you know, Stargate goes kaput at that point. That's why Atlantis, when we get to it, Atlantis ends the way it does. They ended it so we could go to movies.
Well, the, you know, arc of truth, the basic things to take from that movie is it is exactly like they just started right where the series ended. It's like a 2-hour wrap up of the series, really. It's like a 21st episode. But the main thing that I liked about it, you have Marina Bakarin coming back as as Vala's daughter slash the evil head of the Ori, and they have a big battle. It's got a little bit of a Kosh versus Ulkesh thing to it toward the end. But you do bring back the priors, you bring back the hit, like the Pope of the Ori, whoever that guy was, you know. Mm-hmm. You see all that stuff that we had been seeing through seasons 9 and 10 one more time, and they put a pretty decent cap on it. It was a little rushed, and I understand that they had Marina Bakarin for one day, and so that's why everything you see of her is just her floating around this room talking and then fighting, and that's it. You know, she's barely in it, but at least she's in it. You know, there's some, it gives you the minimum necessary amount of closure, I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
So that's the first half of our conversation about Stargate in all of its various forms. We will be back in an upcoming episode very soon to talk about Stargate Atlantis and Stargate Universe, and of course Stargate Continuum, the other SG-1 movie. In the meantime, we have to thank our patrons who keep our programs on the air. For as little as $1 a month, you can join them and be part of the White Rocket Entertainment family, helping to support all of our various shows, all of our various across the network. Our current patrons as of this recording include Brendan O'Dwyer, Samuel Salvatore, Christopher Burleson, Carl Von Drunker, Phil Amthor, Willie Carden, Susan Trawick, Ben Spooner, Stephen Thompson, Chris Usher, Justin Bean, Steve Trawick, Richard Stevens, Johnny Caldwell, Reynolds Wolf, Joshua Corbett, Valiant Hermes, Jacob and Robin Fleming, Clay Henson, Ann Kanzian, Catherine England, George Gaston, Will Summerford, John McCune, Tom Anderson, David Evers, Andrew Barber, Timothy, Steve Harlan, Dan Thompson, Wes Atkinson, Rich Reimer, Jared Albrick, William Glenn Matthews, Joel Beckham, Theodore Geary, Shannon Butson, Taylor, David Hegler, Mickey B., Hugh Anderson, Shane Bailey, Mick Vigicana, Chris Thrash, Logan Chilton, Tony Perry, Alex Nguyen, Josh Teal, David Simpson, Earl Ricks, Mike Finley, C.T. Wayne, Dave Powell, Donnie Reynolds, Wade Carson, Ivor Evans, John Zavachin, Chris Camo, Darren Pyle, Chris, Wardam Wade, Jason Albrick, Randall Walker, Ben Amos, Ruth and Darren Sutherland, Patrick Williams, Rob Morgan, Stephen Schuster, James Taylor, John Stubbs, Kenneth Brent Range, Nicholas Craig, Russell Milling, Matthew Wagstaff, Joey Miller, Mark Squire, Spanky, Brant Rumble, J.W. Rice, Michael Morton, Lawrence Kane, and our one-time and anonymous donors. Thank you all so much for helping keep the show on the air. You too can join the crowd, join the fun, be part of the family, get lots of benefits. Just go to patreon.com and look for Van Plexico or White Rocket, or go to www.plexico.net. And for as little as $1 a month, you can be part of this and get all the various benefits, including keeping our shows on the air. We thank you very much, and we will see you guys down the road.
Griffin, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.